Hi, I'm Max Bergman.
And I'm Donatien Ruiz.
And this is The Europhile, a podcast where we look at Europe through a Washington lens.
Welcome to another episode of The Europhile. This week, Max is traveling, so Otto is joining as guest host for the second appearance on The Europhile. Hello, Otto.
Hello.
Today, we're going to discuss the recent meeting of NATO foreign ministers, including Secretary General Stoltenberg's idea to set up a five-year, 100 billion euro fund. After that, we'll briefly discuss the latest meeting of the EU-US Trade and Technology Council in Leuven, Belgium, and the results from the Slovak presidential election's second round. Finally, we'll turn to a conversation with Ignacio Molina, senior analyst at the Elcano Royal Institute, to discuss Spain's EU policy and the future of the EU. We hope you enjoy the show. All right, Otto, let's start with NATO. There was a ministerial last week, and they discussed a range of options, mostly focused on Ukraine, to maintain the flow of weapons that we're supplying Ukraine with, and of course, to consider what happens after the November election in the US. There's movement, or the effort seems to be around proofing the support we're currently providing to Ukraine for any kind of scenario for what comes out in November. So tell us a little bit about what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like this meeting is kind of like catnip to the hosts of this podcast, myself included, in the sense that it draws on a lot of the things we've discussed over the past few months. NATO's continuing role in European security, the EU's growing role as both a financier and an actor in European security, and sort of the interplay between those two institutions. And so I think the reaction to this ministerial meeting, and particularly Secretary General Stoltenberg's announcement of this idea for 100 billion euro plan to continue supporting Ukraine, I think it's sort of a microcosm of the different actors, particularly here in DC, and how they view this interplay between NATO and the EU. Let me start by saying that we have, on this podcast, of course, advocated for a greater role for the EU and European security. Max and I wrote a report last year in which we called for the EU to borrow jointly for European defense, both to support Ukraine and to regenerate depleted European militaries. And so, of course, I am always skeptical of sort of efforts by NATO that will sort of encroach on what I and Max also view as sort of the fiscal firepower of the EU that can be leveraged to solve some of these problems. And I think a lot of sort of like-minded think tankers and European officials reacted in a similar way. You know, this is another attempt by NATO to box out the EU in European defense. And, you know, perhaps not coincidental that this 100 billion euro figure was thrown around. I think there are more nuanced takes floating around there around.
But before we get to those, let's step back a little. What is the plan? Well, what is the idea? I should say, I don't think there's a set plan with this 100 billion. Is this just an idea Stoltenberg threw out to just test the waters? And what does that look like in practice? What does that mean? Is it pooling contributions from member states that they are already planning on sending to Ukraine? Who oversees that fund, decides how to allocate it? What does that mean?
Well, I think the mixed responses are a direct sort of corollary to that lack of clarity in his messaging. It's not clear whether, you know, the Ukraine Defense Contact Group, which is, you know, informally also known as the Rammstein Group, which is this format that is sort of informally led by Secretary Austin to coordinate weapons deliveries to Ukraine, whether that would sort of be the coordinating framework, and whether you would use the sort of NATO calculus in terms of sort of the percentage allocation that NATO countries would contribute to this. It's not clear whether this would be conjuring of new funds or whether this would be existing funds. One of the sort of premises for his announcement was, we have this supplemental stock in the US Congress. There's uncertainty about the election. How can we sort of Trump-proof continued flow of security to Ukraine? And so, given that the funding for this new plan that he's floated is uncertain and may require the supplemental that is currently stuck in Congress, tells me that there are some details that haven't been worked out. So it's a great question about sort of the logistics and the details around where would this money come from. But I think the lack of clarity in his messaging is really short-sighted and counterproductive.
That's interesting, because I feel like it's almost the Macron method of, let me just throw out a pretty outside the box idea, see what happens, and then based on that, relate back a little bit to still get to some middle ground.
Yeah, but I think there's value in that, obviously, right? We have an incredibly important summit coming up that is both important for the future of the alliance, but also politically on both sides of the Atlantic. And I think this is me reading into Secretary Stoltenberg's statement. This is not, you know, insider information or anything, but this is clearly a sort of communications push. This is the way to rally allies around this upcoming summit, sort of try to stem the tide of some of the criticism that has been floating, again, on both sides of the Atlantic. But it makes you wonder, you know, it just seems incredibly short-sighted, because if you keep throwing out these incredibly ambitious plans that you're not able to follow through on, then what's the real value in that if you keep doing that 5-10 years from now? So it seems like a comms play that is perhaps a bit short-sighted.
That's interesting. I think the Belgian foreign minister actually said we need to not make promises we can't keep. But there's other interesting comments too around the amount itself, for example. We could be open to it, but we need to have a proper formula that takes into account what is the need, and let's work on that based on that need. So there's potential there. But what are the concerns around duplication with the EU? You'd mentioned the work that you and Max have done. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so in terms of the value that I see in this push from Stoltenberg, I think obviously the Rammstein Group has been incredibly valuable in coordinating weapons deliveries to Ukraine. And in terms of combatant command, organizing, you know, war fighting in Europe, that is really where NATO comes into play. And in securing that European militaries have the right capabilities to fight against Russia if that scenario ever came to the forefront. And I think that sort of projection and that scenario planning can be incredibly helpful in sort of maintaining the stable flow of security for Ukraine. But it's all about the money. It's all about where will these funds come from? And that's where I wish there was a little bit more coordination and interplay and perhaps strategic thinking on behalf of Secretary Stoltenberg. It seems like a very short-sighted play where if there was just some division of labor between the EU and NATO in this regard, where the EU clearly has the financial and fiscal muscle to conjure up funds of this magnitude, and then NATO can play a complementary role, or the EU can play a complementary role to NATO, however you want to phrase it. But in terms of planning which capabilities are required when for Ukraine, that's really where NATO comes into play. I don't quite understand why it's necessary to throw around these figures that NATO clearly cannot come up with. NATO has no track record of conjuring up funds of this sort. You know, the only sort of, if you want to look at joint funding, there's the Diana Defense Innovation Accelerator, which is meager. I believe it's like 2.5 billion euros and nothing of the sort of this fund. And so again, it feels like a communications play. It feels like a way to sort of rally allies ahead of this important summit. And it just feels detrimental to the long-term credibility of the alliance.
The rallying the allies part is interesting to me because I don't feel like that's what it's doing. Because when the reactions that we've seen coming out of this are all over the place.
Yeah.
You have some ministers saying, we're okay discussing this. Let's see where this goes. Others, for example, in Hungary are saying, absolutely not. We don't want to be involved in this. NATO shouldn't be involved, or there shouldn't be even the impression that this is NATO's war. And if we pull some of the coordination into NATO, that's what's going to happen. So setting aside Hungary's skin in this game, I think that's an argument that makes a little bit of sense. So that's interesting to me that he would potentially see this as a way to rally it. Also because we've discussed on the eve of the 75th summit, this summer here in Washington, there's tension between wanting to announce something big versus wanting to really focus on the celebration and the celebratory aspect of this anniversary to really show a united front. And I'm not sure this does that.
I completely agree. And I think the German reaction was quite interesting, actually. I noted down here that Annalena Baerbock noted that it was essential to create reliable long-term structures to help Ukraine. If you are a Europhile listener and you have been listening to our conversations about German foreign policy in the past few months, does anyone really believe that Olaf Scholz will sign off on a big NATO push that would potentially make, in the eyes of at least, you know, the people in the Kremlin, but also to third party countries, make NATO, you know, more of a part to this ongoing war. That just seems incredibly unlikely. And it seems to me like this is also sowing or sort of spurring on the divisions in the German government, because we all know how Annalena Baerbock feels about this conflict and Germany's role in supporting Ukraine. The last thing I'll add to the sort of communications, the posturing side of this is, you know, if I was a security official in the Kremlin, this is exactly what I would want from a messaging point of view as well. You know, look, this is NATO, you know, gumming up this $100 billion fund. They are now, you know, a party to the war. We are fighting the West. We are fighting NATO. This is not just about Ukraine. So again, seems to me like a short-sighted communications play that hasn't sort of thoroughly been thought through.
I guess we'll see where this goes. This ministerial was just last week, so I'm sure there'll be more reactions coming in and more dialogue in the next ministerials leading up to the summit. So we'll be sure to keep on top of that here at the Eurofile. But let's move from one meeting to another. So in Leuven, in my home country of Belgium, the Trade and Tech Council met up to discuss a range of issues that they have discussed for 3 years now, I believe, since 2021. So do you want to recap a little bit what the plan was going into the TTC?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think sort of a primary objective of this meeting was sort of to stem some of the concerns that political changes on either side of the Atlantic would threaten the forum's survival. One of the things that was noted was that the momentum will continue whatever happens in terms of political leadership. And I think there are sort of two critical outcomes, or perhaps lack thereof, that is noteworthy. I think one of them was there was an extension by 3 years of this EU-US cooperation on identifying disruptions in the semiconductor sector, with a particular emphasis on these mainstream legacy chips from China. And if you look at the joint communication, it says that the two parties would share market intelligence about non-market policies and practices, which they argue prevail in China, and continue to consult on planned action to address distortions on the global supply chain. In terms of what didn't happen, some of what sort of pundits have been looking at over the past 3 years is progress on a critical minerals agreement. And this is something that Brussels has been keen to secure, a deal with Washington that would allow critical minerals mined or processed in Europe to qualify for these US clean vehicles tax breaks that were announced in the IRA. But alas, that didn't happen during this meeting, although EU Commissioner Valdis Dombrovskis noted that new EU rules that are forthcoming that will ban products made using forced labor have sort of raised the prospect of concluding this critical minerals deal. Alas, no progress was made on that front for this particular meeting.
Yeah, the TTC is, I think, caught between a rock and a hard place in that it was started in 2021 as meant to be more of a technical channel of dialogue on complicated issues around trade, around technology, emerging and disruptive technologies, semiconductors, etc. But from a positive restart of EU-US dialogue on these issues. And it has done a lot in that context to create more channels of dialogue, to have the right people talk to each other at various levels, including at the very technical level, because that's part of what created issues with the IRA, for example, or some other regulations coming out of Brussels, which is the technical people are really focused on getting those regulations out without thinking about the bigger picture. And here's our biggest investment partner on the other side of the Atlantic. We probably want to limit the amount of decisions we make that would negatively impact these investment flows between the two sides and trade between the two sides. So this has done a lot. The TTC has done a lot in that regard. Since its inception, a lot of us observers have had such high hopes, though, that it would fix a lot of the trade problems that predated the Trump administration, even though it got worse, obviously, under the Trump administration. But things around this Boeing-Airbus dispute and then during the Trump administration, steel and aluminum. And the TTC has not really made big strides in that area. That's what makes it hard for me to have strong feelings one way or another. I think it depends what you're judging it on. However, we're all staring at the same thing, which is obviously European Parliament elections in the spring and then US elections in the fall. One will be a lot more consequential, I think, in this regard. But still, the College of Commissioners is going to turn around. There have been changes in national governance and parties at the helm in different European countries. So different commissioners are going to show up in September. And that might impact some of that as well. But I think on the technical side, we've seen a lot of joint world maps, recommendations, and things on AI, on how online platforms regulate, you know, things that potentially spur gender-based violence. So there's a lot of output, but it's not been elevated to a more strategic level. And that might be the next step, is how do we get the TTC to be something like this? Because when you look at, and I think the joint conclusions from this meeting show that weird in between, because it is, the statement is so long. It's something like 18 pages and it covers everything under the sun, but it also mentions the importance to remain relevant, strategic, and timely for the TTC. It makes specific mention of the electoral process on both sides of the Atlantic. And it says that for the rest of 2024, they're going to engage stakeholders on their views of the future of the TTC. So they're trying to navigate both. They also recap all of the things that they've covered during the last 3 years. So there's clearly an acknowledgement that there needs to be a transition in what the TTC is used for. But they also spent 18 pages going over all the different aspects. And in terms of messaging what the priorities are for the TTC, that makes it very hard.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think this is another sort of messaging challenge. Going back to your point about the TTC having an incredibly narrow scope, actually, when it was launched in 2021, and then it's become this catch-all that's supposed to solve
every trade technology. 10 working groups.
No, exactly. I think just to add to your pessimism, if I may, this seems to me like this was sort of the last best chance to solve many of these issues before we head into potentially turbulent times, both in the US and in the College of Commissioners in Brussels. If you look at something like this big ticking time bomb that is these, you know, 2018 tariffs that were sort of put on hold by the Biden administration, they were then punted into March 2025 when these steel and aluminum tariffs will resume. If you look at the current makeup of, you know, EU commissioners and Biden's cabinet, you know, Gina Raimondo and Margrethe Vestager are like best pals and incredibly forward leaning when it comes to transatlantic cooperation. And not saying that, you know, this forum was the best possible avenue to solve some of these ongoing disputes, but if they weren't able to do it, then God help us.
Then not it's to looking, be dramatic or anything.
And it's looking pretty bleak. Even in the Biden 2.0, new, more rightward lurching European Commission. So I don't know. My expectations were fairly low heading into this particular meeting as well. But it just seems as if we've spent the past few years not really making a lot of progress, and politicians on both sides of the Atlantic not really seizing the moment and sort of realizing that this may be the last sort of era of substantial transatlantic cooperation before we head into very different times.
Yeah, and I suppose we'll see. Who knows? There might still be big moves coming from this administration, for example, in the next few months on the executive side. And I think in Europe, regardless of what happens, there will still be, I think, a fairly pro-trade majority within, obviously, the Commission and in the European Parliament. But I agree with you that in terms of big announcements that require some level of political capital, we're not there, and that'll be a 2025 problem.
Let's why don't we segue into our last topic for today, which is the second round of the Slovakian presidential election. So Donatien, could you describe to us what took place over this weekend?
Yes, this was the second round. And speaking of last chances for some things, this was the second round of the presidential election. And the two candidates were on kind of opposite side of several issues. The two big ones coming to mind is Ukraine and the level of pro-Russian lean. And on the second one being just democratic rules and norms. And Peter Pellegrini, who is an ally of Prime Minister Robert Fico, won the election. It was a larger win than expected. He won by about 6 percentage points when polls showed more of a dead heat going into it. But Pellegrini will be the next president, which means that both the prime minister and the president's office are now held by mostly SMER politicians. Pellegrini used to be in SMER and had a breakaway party, but same thing. What they regard politics the same way. They have similar views on Slovakia's place in the EU, on Ukraine, on Russia, on democratic backsliding, although I don't think they would call it that. So that's part of the issue. Now, the president's office is not a powerful office in Slovakia, but it still can veto some laws. It can challenge them in the constitutional court, which is what happened with Čaputová, the current holder of the office, with some of the criminal justice reforms that Fico is trying to pass. And the concern here is that we've already seen Fico take pretty active steps towards what I would call the Orbán playbook, which some people have also called the Putin playbook, which is changing the rules for how you prosecute corruption, on attacking the judiciary and the media, making clear allegations that they are biased one way or another, so really not respecting the separation of powers, trying to take over the independence of the media. And by takeover, I mean reduce it and put allies at the head of some of those institutions. Same thing with museums in the cultural world, which allows them to change the narrative a little bit. So it's not great news, I will say. The turnout was positive, though. It was 61%, which is apparently the second highest in Slovakia's history. But I think that means we'll need to really keep a close eye on Slovakia's trajectory over the next few months, because all I see here is that Fico will feel emboldened.
What do you think the implications will be in the European Council? Because we're coming out of this period with so much optimism after the Polish election. And, you know, pundits were saying, you know, that, you know, this will isolate Hungary and make it easier to sort of get comprehensive stuff through the European Council. In your opinion, are we back to that sort of two-headed monster that can stop progress from happening at the European level? Or is this a different landscape that we're looking at?
I think it's a little bit different, just because Poland at the time, before the elections last year, was, I would say, at a more advanced stage of disruption than Slovakia is now. But we're not too far off. And Fico seems a lot more brazen in disrupting decisions that he's making or trying to extract concessions from those meetings and from his European partners the way he wasn't when he was in power before. He was not always the most helpful, but he was not as obstructive as I think he can be now. So I have concerns that we're not quite there yet. But I think we're going to get there because the steps he's taking domestically are what got Orbán in trouble with Brussels. And I think Brussels will want to send clear signals to Bratislava that that's not going to fly. And let's see what Fico wants to do with that.
And on that sunny note,
sorry,
let's move to our interview with Ignacio Molina. We are thrilled to be joined by Ignacio Molina for a conversation about Spain's foreign policy and EU policy. Ignacio is a senior analyst at the Elcano Royal Institute and a lecturer at the Department of Politics and International Relations at the Universidad Autónoma de Madrid. He has served as an external expert consultant to several institutions, including the European Parliament, the European Commission, the Spanish Council of State, and the Spanish Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Ignacio, welcome to the Eurofile.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's a real pleasure to be here today to deal with Spain and the European policy of Spain. Here I am. Thank you.
Why don't we kick off the conversation? If you could perhaps just outline sort of the current state of Spanish domestic politics and perhaps their impact on Spain's place in the EU. We are a year out from Spanish PM Pedro Sanchez calling snap elections, in which he sort of clinched victory from the jaws of defeat, a very difficult electoral terrain that he was able to navigate and sort of clinch this very narrow victory and was able to keep his government going. So what's the status like in Madrid right now?
When you look to the conversation in Spain among politicians, also experts, you see too much noise. Even you can measure polarization. Probably Spain is perhaps the member state most polarized. Confrontation in politics between government and opposition. But interestingly, when you look to why that polarization, why this confrontation, it's very interesting that it's very, let's say, politics-based and not policy-based. And this is particularly important regarding the European policy of Spain, what the different political parties from the extreme left to the extreme right think about Europe. And it's amazing, it's very remarkable that being so polarized on domestic politics when it comes to, discussing about the future of European integration, for example, war in Ukraine and the position of Spain on that, or economic governance connected to the Eurozone, or reforms to be taken and connect to the digital agenda, to the green agenda. It's interesting to see that both parties, I mean, the Socialist Party now in office and the Popular Party, the main party on the oppositions, agree in most topics, and they vote the same thing in the European Parliament. That's the contrast, because in other member states, you don't have this degree of polarization, but they disagree on EU, immigration, the euro, Ukraine, and not the case in Spain. So it's interesting because this is this contrast between extreme polarization, but consensus, and particularly on Europe. It's true that when you look to Vox and the far-right party or Sumar, but Sumar is the new brand for Podemos, much more pragmatic than Podemos. Well, they are more critical with the European Union, but they don't use the typical topics connected to the European Union, such as immigration or trade, as the most important topics in the agenda of the anti-mainstream parties. They prefer, again, to go for domestic politics. And it's basically Catalonia. Catalonia was very traumatic. The last 10 years has been difficult for relation between Catalonia and the rest of Spain, in particular 2017 when this unilateral declaration of independence came. So it's Catalonia has to do with corruption scandals, but not policies. I think that's interesting. And it's good for the European Union, I mean, for this position of Spain being a very pro-European member state, because this is not in danger. Well, not in danger to some extent, because it is so polarized, the domestic, that there is the risk to upload that polarization to the European level. And even if Socialist Party and Popular Party still vote together in the European Parliament and they agree on most issues connected to the European agenda, for example, everything connected to the amnesty law to the former Catalan president, the opposition is taking to Europe and blaming the government to attack division of power, rule of law. And there is also this risk of also eroding this pro-European consensus. But so far, the most interesting thing is to see that contrast. So Spain, contrary to when you look to Italy, to France, even Germany, of course, Poland, the opposition party is characterized for being anti-European. I'm thinking on Alternative for Deutschland in the case of Germany. But in the case of Spain, both parties are very, very pro-European.
And we've also seen, at least from my view, Spain really rising to a leading voice at the European level. In the Council in particular, and obviously the High Representative being a Spanish official helps as well, but also a pretty successful, I would say, rotating presidency of the Council of the EU last year in the second half of the year. So there's been a lot of movement there that I think you're exactly right, wasn't really affected by the dynamics at the domestic level, because they do agree on a lot, but the sticking point are pretty sensitive. And for example, you mentioned Catalonia, there's snap elections next month in May. There's also been decisions made by the Sanchez government to form a government based on a coalition that relies on regional parties. And now we're seeing Puigdemont moving to the south of France to try to run the campaign for Catalonia's regional elections from there. So I'm curious a little bit about that dynamic and how it's playing out at the moment. Are you seeing in the population, public opinion, are people more supportive of what Sanchez is trying to do to really get over this hump? Because it's been 10 years. There's so much tension. How do we get past this? Or are people saying, no, it's going too far. This is a risk for the way the Spanish state is now?
That's a very good question, and I don't have an answer. I really think that Catalonia now is, when you compare the current situation and 5 years ago, it's completely different. Nobody, we have polls. Less than 10% of Catalans think that independence can really be achieved. Also because there is no majority of Catalans in favor of independence. The latest poll is around 30% that want independence, another third that want a new kind of compromise to accommodate demands for more self-government, another third that are very much in favor of statu quo. So there's really no majority. And the Catalan Nationalist Party realized that on their voters. But they still, well, perhaps because they are two nationalist parties competing for the same voter, when you listen to the rhetoric, it's still, well, we want a new referendum or what. But everybody knows that this is not going to happen. In part, it's merit of Pedro Sánchez, because he arrived to office in 2018 when the federal intervention to Catalonia was still there. He really made those agreements with Catalan Nationalist Party. Very obvious that the situation is now more peaceful. But, that was your question, there are many Spaniards, in particular those who vote for PP, but not only them, some socialist party too, that thinks that perhaps has gone too far. And also because this amnesty, not a pardon, but an amnesty to push them on, so before being trailed to have an amnesty, has been perhaps too transactional. So I give you the amnesty and your party vote for the appointment of Pedro Sánchez as prime minister last year. Well, this is more controversial because it's not a question of, well, we have now a more peaceful situation in Catalonia because we are accommodating. And of course, they are not going to become independent, but we are going to have a new kind of a deal. No, it's not that, or it's not only that. It's also this transaction, which is perhaps for many voters and many outwards to some extent. But yes, it's true. And Pedro Sánchez, on the other hand, not just domestic, but foreign policy and European policy, he has taken advantage of this consensus that I mentioned before, because he is proactive. He have some successes in the external action. And now Spain, it's true that Spain is more proactive, because after 10 years of economic crisis and then territorial crisis and even political crisis, so is Podemos, the Catalan independence movement, and of course the Eurozone crisis that hit Spain particularly. After that, Spain is an important member state. Pedro Sánchez is ambitious on the European level. And yes, now it's very obvious that Spain also, perhaps because of Brexit, now is more important as actually the fourth member state of the European Union institutional weight.
I think that's a good segue into some foreign policy related topics. And I think in particular, going from this conversation about domestic debates, about domestic independence movements towards some of the things that's going on, in particular in the Western Balkans and in the Middle East. And it would be really interesting to unpack sort of Spain's evolving position on recognition of a Palestine state and sort of contrasting that a bit with recognition of Kosovo's statehood. Because we've seen, you know, within the EU, Spain, along with Greece, have perhaps been the foremost opponents of Kosovo's statehood. And of course, in Madrid's case, this has been linked to the Basque and the Catalan independence movements. But in January, Spain confirmed that it would recognize Kosovo passports, allowing Kosovars to travel freely within Schengen. Spain was among, you know, a group of non-recognizer countries in the EU, amongst them being Slovakia, Romania, Cyprus, and Greece. But Spain was really the last that dug in its heels and refused access. And then I think even more prominent and sort of relevant to this discussion, in early April, José Manuel Álvarez, the Spanish foreign minister, confirmed that Madrid would recognize Palestinian statehood by July of this year. He added that the decision was directly linked to the October 7th attacks and the ensuing military operations in Gaza by Israeli forces, adding that recognizing Palestinian statehood would sort of be key to ending that conflict. Could you unpack the interplay between these foreign policy considerations and the domestic considerations between these sort of independence movements, both within Spain and beyond its borders?
That's a very good question. When you look to the Western world, NATO members, European Union members, US, and you look to Kosovo and look to Palestine, you see that it is paradox to be so reluctant to recognize a Kosovo statehood and even to just to accept, for example, Kosovo passports. So even to be pragmatic in the case of Kosovo, so very rigid in rejecting the statehood of Kosovo. And when you compare with, in the case of Palestine, being one of the leaders in the Western world to try to support the two-state solution, and well, it's interesting. And it is, as you say, connected to the, well, everything in foreign policy at the end is connected to the domestic level. But very briefly, let me start with the case of Kosovo. Only 5 member states in the European Union don't recognize Kosovo. All of them is because of domestic reasons. Cyprus, because of the north of the island. Romania is because of the Hungarian, Slovakia, Hungarian minorities. And in the case of Spain, it's very obvious. No? You have the Catalonia and the Basque Country, two important regions with a strong nationalist movement. As I said, no majorities or in Basque Country or the Catalan in favor of independence, but well, you see more or less 1/3 of the Catalan, 1/3 of Basque that would support independence. And that gives Spain this fear of recognizing new state. Well, yes, that's true. But if we go back to 2008, when Kosovo declared independence, the real reason why the Spanish government didn't recognize Kosovo was very legal, very legalistic. Was only 4 years after Iraq war. At that time, the socialist government was in office with Prime Minister Rodríguez Zapatero and was very traumatic in Spain because it was after a terror attack in 2004, then came elections and was connected to a jihadist terrorism and the socialist opposition when Aznar was Prime Minister were very much against Iraq war. And they say this work is illegal because there is no resolution of a Security Council of the United Nations. And when Kosovo declared independence in 2008, there was a legal interpretation connected to that that was also illegal. Of course, domestic reasons are important, but it was also very important that very rigid view that it's not legal. Even that the International Court of Justice, some years after, declared that the independence of Kosovo was not illegal. But, well, now we were trapped in that decision. I personally disagree with that decision of not recognizing Kosovo when the European Council said that was not a precedent, that was very special because there was a special report by Amartya Tisari, a former Finnish president, that was the only solution. But Spain preferred to wait and even lead in particular for Latin American countries to say, well, until Serbia recognized Kosovo. I really think that decision was very, very debatable. But now, of course, Spain now is in favor of reviving the enlargement agenda in the Western Balkans. It's very obvious that Kosovo at some point will have to be normalized their relation. And as you said, in the last month, Spanish diplomacy has been more pragmatic. And for example, the Spanish rotating presidency in the second half of last year, there was an informal European Council, formal summit in Granada in South Spain, and the Kosovo president attended. So now it's more normalized. But yes, at some point, Spain will have to take decisions. And perhaps now the contribution of Spain to the Kosovo-Serbia conflict could be to help Serbia accept some kind of arrangement. We know it's very, very extremely difficult, but perhaps Spain, being one important member state not recognizing Kosovo, could play a role in helping Serbia to accept that. On Palestine, well, Palestine is extremely interesting because for domestic reason and for foreign policy consideration, it makes sense what Spain is doing. Spain was a country that recognized Israel only in the mid-80s. Yes, it's interesting to underline that. During the Franco regime, Spain didn't recognize Israel, and then it took a decade of democracy to do it. But after that, the official position of Spain to Israel has been even to ask for apologies for what Spain did to the Jewish communities in the 15th century. Spain has given a Spanish nationality to Sephardic Jews. So it has been a policy of trying to reconcile with Israel. But the domestic public opinion of Spain is in particular on the left, but not only the left, but well, very much close to the Palestine cause for historical reasons. And this difficult acceptance of the state of Israel historically plays a role, but also for foreign policy consideration. So for this government, this is a government of, it's a left-wing government. So for the government, and it's difficult to have a progressive foreign policy. So it's good to give to your voters something that they can, be happy with. Because at the same time, the Spanish government has been very, very realistic with Morocco with more spending on defense. But on foreign policy consideration, if you think that which is the role of Spain in the Euro-Atlantic community, well, the added value of Spain is a very good relation with Latin American countries and also with Southern Mediterranean countries, with Arabic countries. So for Spain, it's important for being more influential to demonstrate in Latin America and in the Arab world that there is a Western European country that understands this cause of these countries who are unhappy with the Western attitude towards the Middle East conflict. At the same time that you are giving your voters something that they are happy with, you are improving your position of moral authority or influence in those regions that are particularly important for Spanish foreign policy.
And increasingly, that's the position of a lot of member states in the EU too. So it contributes to Spain leading role in those conversations. You mentioned the spending on defense and security role. I'm curious about this, both under this current government and, say, if future PP government, if we got there. What's your assessment of Spain's role within NATO, for example? Because obviously they host a naval base there, geographically super important as well, obviously. So how do you assess the role it has played within the alliance and European defense as a whole over the last few years?
NATO membership was controversial in Spain. It's no longer controversial. And it is also very interesting. In the mid-80s, when Spain joined the European Union, there was a referendum on NATO membership and Spain was very divided. But now, when you ask Spaniards about NATO membership, well, there's a huge support. And even those parties more on the left, Podemos, no, were not particularly against NATO. This was not part of the discourse. We had a summit of NATO in Madrid 2 years ago, and Spain is committed to increasing in security and defense. Now Spain is one of the member states of NATO that has been listed on the defense and security when the U.S. government, well, not just the Republican, Trump, but also Biden. So the both administration, the two last administration has pushed for more spending. Spain is one of the targets because Spain only spends 1.3 or 1.4% of GDP on defense. Since 2 years ago, the commitment of this government is to do that. I think it's interesting because it's not very popular to say, and we are going to increase spending not on welfare state, not on health or education, but on defense, considering the voters of the socialist, the coalition socialist radical left, let's say. Even though the government, the Ministry of Defense and the Prime Minister are. But of course, and this is very much connected to the Russian aggression to Ukraine. So this is good because, I mean, the Russian aggression of Ukraine is terrible. But I mean, it has been opened the window for understanding that security is expensive. And even the lack of guarantee that the US is going to be behind European security. And we know that after 4 years of Donald Trump, and perhaps wins again, or any other U.S. president that don't think that European security should be paid for, basically by the U.S., there is this now this consensus that, well, even if it's not very popular, Spain has to spend more on security and defense. And apart from the spending, you are very right. So the geopolitical position of Spain, and I mentioned this special relationship with two important regions, Latin America and Southern Mediterranean and the rest of Africa. I mean, it gives Spain a very important role in the future of this European security connected to, let's hope, NATO with US involved security and defense, this space of Western defense. But now in the last 2 years, it's very visible that there are more political support to that. Before was low profile consideration. Well, we have the US, we have NATO securing, and this now the Spanish political parties and the Spanish public are aware. Not at the same level that Poland or Finland, for obvious reason, but that this has to be a priority.
Ignacio, unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you so much for a fascinating conversation, and thank you for joining us on the Eurofile.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It was a pleasure.
That's it for today's episode. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us a review wherever you get your podcast. You may also be interested in our sister podcast, Russian Roulette, which covers the latest on Vladimir Putin's Russia and the ongoing war in Ukraine. Our thanks to our producer, Sean Falk, and to Otto Svensson for coordinating and researching this episode and for guest hosting today. We'll be back soon with another assessment of Europe through a Washington lens. Until next time.